Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann. For thousands of poor Ohio residents, putting a roof overhead is an economic burden. Increased rent prices and greater demand makes the pressure to find affordable housing even tougher for the state's poorest households. Now, a new report has found that not enough is being done to provide financially strapped Ohioans with a decent, safe place to live. According to the report, a federal tax credit housing program places a majority of low-income Ohio families into racially segregated and high-poverty neighborhoods. Joining us in the studio to discuss the report is director at the Ohio Poverty Law Center, Janet Hales. Welcome to All Sides, Janet.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is a very key, important report. What were some of the findings that you found?
Some of the findings are that the low-income housing tax credit program allocates tax credits to developers, nonprofit and for-profit developers, to develop low-income housing. And those allocations of the tax breaks are going to developments for families and seniors and permanent supportive housing. And the housing for families is being placed in neighborhoods where there's high concentrations of poverty and high concentrations of African Americans and ethnic minorities. And the implications of that go to the very heart of the Fair Housing Act and the opportunity for choice and the opportunity to live where you can have access to the resources that many of us take for granted. And that's basically it. It covers metropolitan areas, some suburban areas.
This is just Ohio.
Yes, it's only Ohio.
Well, you know, haven't we known this for a while, that we're giving tax incentives, and that's really what they are, right, to developers?
Yes.
But they're building, and they have been building, in low-income areas for the most part. So I guess part of that report really isn't a surprise, right?
That's right. That's right.
But what did you find that was a surprise?
I think that we, in looking at the allocations over the last couple of years, we saw that there was, or we thought we saw that there was a decrease in the number of family developments. And in fact, it wasn't really a surprise. It just showed that that was true. And the real purpose of the report was just to gather together the real facts and not to necessarily be, you know, a criticism or an indictment, but just to have the facts out there in front of people so that we can have everything there going forward.
So you could point to data and say, we've done research and we can see now by the numbers that most of these homes are being built in low-income areas.
That's correct.
So why do developers decide to build in low-income areas?
Well, there's a process, and it's called the qualified allocation. There are allocation credits or credits given for certain characteristics of the developer's applications for the tax credit properties. And so points are given for different things. And that process can be changed around to give more credit for things like placing housing in areas where there isn't a high concentration of poverty, where there isn't a high concentration of African Americans. And the reason for that second characteristic or that second factor is that the Fair Housing Act, it's been in place for nearly 50 years, has always been part of federal policy to decrease historical segregation. Historical segregation, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, well, isn't this social engineering? You know, where, you know, you're deciding where to put these properties. Our suburbs were part of social engineering. There was just a recent piece in the Columbus Dispatch about the many deed restrictions that are still on the books all over Ohio that say no blacks. Yes, that was a very recent article in the Dispatch about those. I think it was in the Dispatch about deed restrictions that are still on the books that kept blacks out of suburbs, out of areas that we would call areas of opportunity, where there are more resources, where there are jobs, where there are grocery stores, banks, access to transportation. So that is why that's important. It's not in and of itself a bad thing. It's the fact that the Fair Housing Act requires state agencies that receive federal money or tax breaks to allocate to further fair housing, not just avoid fair housing discrimination, but to actually promote choice and opportunity and fairness, and to hopefully help undo the social engineering that happened through discrimination. We had zoning restrictions. We had redlining, many things that kept people, relegated to having no choice.
So the developers, though, are doing this. Is it because it's lower cost for them and then they get money back more if they do that? Or isn't there a push to say, if you apply for these tax credits, you have to look at other areas besides the low-income areas?
There is. And in fact, OFA does have a set-aside in their next QAP.
Okay, and OFA and QAP. Don't
yes,
know what
sorry.
Those are.
I'm sorry about that. I should know better because I have struggled with that alphabet soup myself. So OFA is the Ohio Housing Finance Agency. They are the Ohio agency that is responsible for allocating the tax credits. And they put together the process, the points. And by the way, there are these same agencies throughout the United States who are struggling with the same issue and looking at how to allocate the funds and how to change the process to incentivize developers. And I really can't speak for the developers. I don't know if someone is coming on to speak about that issue.
Yes, they are.
I think,
we'll find out a little bit more. Yes.
I think that they probably would say it's more expensive to build in other areas. But that doesn't absolve the allocating agency from its duty to further fair housing.
We're talking about low-income, affordable, and fair housing today. If you've been impacted by this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned the importance of developers building in better neighborhoods. What do you mean by that, and why is that important?
There is increasing evidence about the importance of where children grow up. A lot of legal aid organizations are working in medical legal partnerships. Doctors, physicians, and other people working in those medical legal partnerships will tell you that housing, the conditions, but also the neighborhood, the safeness, the access to high-performing schools all contribute to wellness. They contribute. There are studies that show that where you grew up contributes to your longevity. There are studies that show that children who have access to more to higher performing schools, to other opportunities that we may take for granted, do better. I think it's sort of common sense, really, but there are plenty of studies to support that. I mean, that would be an entirely different, could be a day-long conference. It could be a week-long conference. But there's many more disciplines, not just fair housing groups, but many more disciplines that are recognizing the importance of location in a child's development and their access to things that help their health, their learning, and their social well-being.
But then there are neighbors on the other side who say, you're going to bring in these low-income families. Who's to say they can keep up their property and all of a sudden our property is going to go down in value? And these are sort of the things that they say, maybe crime will go up. Have you heard those arguments?
I read those arguments on the comments to the Cleveland Plain Dealer article yesterday.
And your thoughts?
And there were, I think, maybe 700 comments, and many of them were geared in that way. I think that if you want to, and this is supported by fair housing law, if you want to control certain aspects of property ownership, you put those things in place. You don't keep out people and types of people. So if you want to control the way people keep up their yards, I mean, there are many subdivisions where you can't have big Christmas decorations, those big blow-up things. I mean, there are many ways to control
property value.
Yes. And it doesn't have anything to do with the characteristics of people. And that's where it becomes very concerning. I saw many racial overtones in those comments. And I also saw a lot of people not recognizing what I mentioned earlier, and that is the history behind the efforts to affirmatively further fair housing, the history that shows that people were purposefully kept out of areas that we would consider higher opportunity for years, years and years of our history. It continues today. We continue in the fair housing world. We continue to see cases coming in where people were steered to different neighborhoods. So to say that that's over and that everybody's on a level playing field is not accurate. And that is really what this is about. Let's do some things to put people on a level playing field. It's extremely important to prevent homelessness. This report says nothing about not revitalizing neighborhoods. It says nothing about, we are completely supportive of revitalizing the neighborhoods that exist now, that reinvesting in central city neighborhoods so that they can be great places to live as well.
So we're talking
in Columbus, about like fairness and choice.
Right. Short North, Franklinton, redevelopment, great, close to the downtown. It's what we want for a vibrant city.
Yes.
And on the other hand, some of those folks who live in those areas now maybe not be able to afford those areas.
Yes. And that's happening all over the country. And there are ways to deal with that. There are inclusionary zoning provisions that people are trying, and they're working. There's mixed income housing so that there's the ability for people on lower incomes to stay in neighborhoods right alongside people who can afford to pay much higher rent. That increases the vibrancy of a community, and it keeps the character of the community. And it also means that those great resources that are coming into those neighborhoods benefit the people who are living in those neighborhoods in the first place. And so there are ways to deal with that, and I'm very hopeful that the city of Columbus will take advantage of those. I know there are people working on those issues. So this is really just about leveling the playing field and giving people choices about where they will live and raise their families. The other issue is that the level of family, the allocations for family housing went down over the years. So in 2006, 60% of the allocations, the tax credit allocations, 60% went to family developments. In 2014, less than half went to family developments. And what we're seeing all over the state is that families on low incomes, and by the way, most of them are working. They're working or they have disabilities that keep them from working. Most of them are working. Most of them are working two and three jobs and they're still in poverty. Just because of the kind of jobs that are available right now. They're having a really difficult time finding housing. They're paying, half of their income on housing, which we all know you should only pay a third or less of your income on housing. And then they're having to cut back on other things that they need for their families. So families need places to live that are safe. Another issue is that we have discovered such a big problem with lead poisoning. And typically, private housing for low-income people is older housing. That's what's being rented out. That's what they can afford. And those are the houses that have lead paint. And so that underlines the need for more affordable family housing that is safe.
Are you hopeful for the future then?
I am. I am very hopeful. I think that people recognize the need. They recognize the fairness issue, the issue that that's a true American value, that of fairness, that we all deserve the same opportunity to shine and use our best abilities. But to do that, most of us have had access to some pretty great tools. And we know that what those tools are. We know what the health issues are. Another issue is infant mortality. I mean, there's a huge issue with infant mortality in a lot of the neighborhoods where this affordable housing is being placed. Where, you know, there's a big move on looking at the social determinants of infant mortality. So housing plays a part in that as well. Safe, affordable housing. But
Lots of issues in there. Janet, thank you so much for being here today. Janet Hales is the director at the Ohio Poverty Law Center. Thanks again, Janet.
Thank you, Gail.
And coming up, we continue our conversation about low-income housing. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann. This hour, we're talking about the availability and development of affordable housing in Columbus. We just heard from the Ohio Poverty Law Center regarding a report that found little is being done in Ohio, including Columbus, to build low-income housing in safe, decent neighborhoods. Joining us now in the studio is Housing Administrator in the Department of Development for the City of Columbus, Rita Parise. Welcome, Rita.
Hi.
Also, the Executive Director, Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio, Bill Faith. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Good to see you, Gail.
And the Chief of Staff for the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, Sean Thomas. Sean, welcome to
all
of you.
Thank you.
John, I want to start with you. We just spoke with Janet Hales of the Ohio Poverty Law Center about this report that found that there isn't enough low-income housing being built in better neighborhoods for the entire state. How can we start to fill that gap?
Right. For our agency, our main program is the Housing Tax Credit Program, and I think you talked about that. And the way we allocate the credits is every year we put together what's called a qualified allocation plan. And that plan is done through a very thoughtful, transparent process. And what we try to do is we try to balance a lot of different strategies to address many housing needs. The state has a variety of housing needs that we try to address, including family housing, senior housing, permanent supportive housing. We try to hit different areas of the state, urban, suburban, rural. We do new construction. We also set aside a lot of credits for the preservation of existing housing. So there's a wide range of housing needs that we try to address. And the recent study, you know, we did work with the authors. We provided them the data for that. And definitely the data is accurate. However, our sort of issue with that report is it lacks a lot of the context in terms of those allocation decisions. So, you know, for example, over half those properties in the sample they had were existing properties. And so therefore you can't really move those properties.
They're there.
So that's a very important priority because these properties that we preserve have existing rental assistance from the federal government. And that allows us to serve very extremely low-income households. And if that property is not preserved, you can't move that subsidy to another project. So it's very important to help preserve that project. So
is that what you see as being done here in Columbus when we talk about Franklinton and areas like that?
There are some projects in Columbus that we have that would be like that. But we also – another part of our plan is we want to help spur community revitalization. So in terms of Franklinton, there's a lot of projects in there that we're part of that help revitalize that area. Another one is like the Wyland Park homes that we did. We also have some projects around Children's Hospital, Nationwide Hospital. So it's just a, you know, when you look at the projects, just if you just look at the numbers, yeah, it looks like, okay, well, we have a lot of properties in these high concentrated poverty areas, but it wasn't an arbitrary process. There was definitely policy reasons why we selected those areas, and we're trying to work to improve the plan, and we can talk about that. going forward here.
Rito, with the city and development attitudes toward this, do you see this as a priority for the city, that we try to make new affordable housing in some of these better neighborhoods?
Well, Gail, I think it's really important to point out this particular report focuses on 10 years in a 30-year program. The Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program has been around since 86. 30 years of success to point to. This particular time period, 2006 to 2015, was the period in which we were going through an economic meltdown, mainly driven by real estate. And so the focus at that point in time for all of us working in the housing industry was to work on trying to save neighborhoods, trying to eliminate blight, trying to deal with people who were losing their homes because of foreclosure, and affordable housing throughout our city was extremely important. Going forward, affordable housing continues to be important. We have a tremendous shortage of low-income housing within our community. The location is also important. Certainly, we want to see good housing and opportunity neighborhoods. But frankly, we see most of our neighborhoods as opportunity neighborhoods. We have, with the cooperation of OFA, as Sean indicated, Wyland Park. Wyland Park, 10 years ago, was a huge number of blighted vacant houses. And we now have significant revitalization to the point where there's market rate housing being constructed in that neighborhood without any subsidy whatsoever. We've created a true mixed income community where we've got project-based Section 8 that we've been able to preserve with the city and OFA's assistance. We have low-income housing tax credit properties that have been constructed with the state and city cooperation and the market rate housing that's going on now. So, you know, looking at mixed income communities, looking at revitalization through all of our neighborhoods remains a priority.
Bill, do you see the city as tackling some of these problems that's benefiting folks, Wyland Park an example, or are we still pushing out too many people in these areas?
Well, we're doing both. I mean, you know, as you know, neighborhood revitalization is a key issue. And I sort of object to the characterization that we're not investing in good neighborhoods. I mean, I agree with Rita. We have a lot of good neighborhoods. Some of them happen to have a high percentage of African Americans. Some of them happen to have a high percentage of people in poverty. But when you paint a broad brush this way, it creates an impression that I don't think is entirely accurate. 10% poverty is what they're talking about, a 10% poverty rate. So that includes parts of Clintonville, parts of Northwest Columbus, like Henderson Road, Bethel Road area. It includes parts of Victorian Village, parts of Worthington. I mean, it's kind of a broad brush that's being painted. And while I do think the report illustrates that OFA should do a better job and do more of family housing, particularly in higher opportunity neighborhoods, areas that are predominantly white, you know, with a lower poverty rate, I don't think there's much disputing that that would be a good thing to do. But there's reasons that that doesn't happen as often as we would like. And we could talk more about what some of those reasons may be.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, and we're talking about fair and affordable housing this hour. Many low-income families in Columbus and Ohio are on wait lists to find housing for their needs. If you have a question or comment, if you have anything that you'd like to give us a call about, the number is 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sean, do you think that then Columbus may be doing a better job than some other cities in the state, because this report was statewide?
I'm sure. And again, that's our mission, is to serve the entire state. And if you look throughout the state, you know, a lot of the areas, there's a lot of very massive community revitalization efforts going on. If you take Cincinnati, for example, and over the Rhine, that area has tremendously changed over the last 15 years. And we have several projects in there to help preserve the low-income housing as an area started, as area gentrifies and gets a lot more higher-income folks in that area. So another thing is we work with local housing authorities to help redo their portfolio. And an example in Columbus is the Poindexter redevelopment, and we just funded the third phase this year. But if you look in Akron and Cuyahoga County, Toledo, we've funded other projects like that that they'll demolish the existing public housing, or or redevelop their existing and totally redo it, and, you know, add new amenities for the residents, add new services. And you know, if you talk to those residents in those communities, it's a big change for them, and it helps really improve the community and improve their their lives with these new projects.
Rita, the tax incentives, are they very important to get developers to get on the same page with you and then work in a partnership? I mean, is it about the only way that we can get some of these projects done for low-income folks?
Absolutely, Gail. The cost of development is very high. It's high for a lot of reasons, including the fact that both OFA and the city feel very strongly that we need to do good, sustainable construction. So slapping something together and leaving it for people to live in is not sufficient. We want it to be healthy. We have a lot of children with asthma. We want to make sure that the air quality within the home is good. We want to make sure it's as sustainable as possible. But it's extremely important to get the tax credits. When you look at putting an affordable rental project together, you are looking at somewhere in the vicinity of, 60 to 75% of the total development cost being covered by the equity generated by the tax credits. Given the shrinking resources we have with home and CDBG, this is the only way we can get large-scale production done. Doing 5 units a year is not going to satisfy the incredible need we have for affordable housing in our community.
I'd like to back up, Bill, just because I think people don't necessarily know what we mean by Section 8 housing and the difference for low-income housing and who qualifies for those. Can you kind of explain a bit for us?
Sure. I mean, I pulled up a little bit of data about Columbus particularly, or Franklin County. 46% of the 575,000 households we have in Franklin County, 46% are renters. Right. So this is a renter program we're talking about. So, and, you know, many of them, 24%, are rent burden, which means they pay more than 30% of their income for their rent. So they're going to, they're stretched. Many of them are paying more than 50% of their income for their rent. So this program is one of very few that we have available to try to expand opportunities for affordable housing for those households. And Sean at OFA has a big job because he has to help formerly homeless people get access to housing, people with disabilities, to preserve the old Section 8 stock, which has rent subsidies tied to them. If we don't preserve that, we'll lose those rent subsidies. So that means all the people that are currently in affordable housing will be, could be without if we don't put some effort on that. You know, there's people with disabilities, there's veterans. The long list of people in need that we're talking about is a challenge to anybody. And OFA has actually very little resources to address this problem. I mean, I'd rather us be talking about how do we make this pie bigger so we could help people solve more of their problems instead of saying, let's take it from these people and give it to these people over here. I do think, though, that we should put some more emphasis on opportunities for family housing and have some of those projects be in areas outside of the central city. I don't think any of us are disputing that. That would be a great thing to do. But we have a lot of other competing demands. And when the folks that did the research are calling for a third of the money to go to one area, which is what they're talking about. I mean, I think that's a little skewed. All these other efforts that we're trying to do would have to pay the price for that.
Sean, Bill brought up a point about if we could have more money.
Right.
How do we get more money as a state to do this? I know there's only a limited amount for everyone,
right.
So what do you do?
Well, that has been difficult. And another part of the program is, you have the housing tax credit program that's been out there. And then, unfortunately, other federal programs have also declined over the last 30 years. So more and more people look for the housing credit program to solve more and more housing problems. And the credits go up a little bit each year based on inflation, but it's not enough to keep up with the housing demand. And so this program is part of the federal tax code. So one of the things that we watch very closely is when federal tax reform is talked about, we want to make sure that this credit program is preserved. And the program is supported both by Democrats and Republicans. It's as as politicians go out and see these projects, they see the impact they have. And so we definitely have been stressing to increase the number of credits. And there's actually a bill right now in the Senate. It's unlikely it'll get passed this year with the presidential election and whatnot. But whatever happens with the elections, we're anticipating sometime in the next couple of years the tax reform would happen. And we're very hopeful to keep the tax credit program in the tax code and also have a boost to it so we could do more needs and do a few more projects in areas of high opportunity.
Beth from Columbus, you're on the air. Your comment or question, please.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment that there are – I just went over to, like, Victorian Village in my old neighborhood and went down Wyland Park, and there has been so much building of upscale housing that it's pushing the people of Wyland Park out, and they have nowhere to go. And that's the problem with gentrification. If you don't build enough affordable housing or allow for enough affordable housing, then people just get pushed along, which is why the crime rate is twice as high in the Short North as it was when it first started to become a revitalized neighborhood. And one other thing is that if there are houses that are available around Bryden Road, they're trying to get the community to be more diversified. And, there's houses that are ready to be moved into. And, yes, it is rent, but it could be a home assistance to do a rent to buy. One is just right across from my friend's place. So the only problem that was wrong with the house was that they had an outstanding water bill. And everything else about the house is fine.
Okay, Beth, thank you. Those are good thoughts to think about. Comments from any of you on Wyland Park, for one.
Well, she raised just a good point in general, and that is in looking at the data and making allocation decisions, if you just look at the poverty rate, you know, as Bill mentioned, you know, some of these areas, might cross that threshold in terms of being defined as high poverty. But there are other things going on in that neighborhood that are, you know, maybe the neighborhood is on its upswing. And so we've been working with the Ohio State Kirwan Institute to develop an opportunity index that looks at additional factors, not just poverty, but also look at the schools, transportation, factors in the housing and neighborhood, health and environment. So it's more of a comprehensive look at an area. And we included that in our plan this past year. And we've received a few applications in these higher opportunity index areas. And so next year we're tweaking the plan a little bit and hopefully get more in those areas. But you know, we want to look at the definition more comprehensively and not just strictly just high poverty, but there's other things to look at.
But I think the caller makes an excellent point. And if you take just the Wyland Park example for a second, I mean, we used to call that area Uzi Alley. I mean, that's what it was called. I mean, the people in the media called it that. There were, you know, people that knew the neighborhood because there was a lot of crime, a lot of gang violence, a lot of other problems. And there happened to be a very large scattered site Section 8 development that went throughout the North End and out east. It was operated by Broad Street Management, a slumlord. And it was taken over by Community Properties of Ohio, and they did a series of tax credit deals to improve the quality of that housing, maintain it as affordable housing for low-income people. They deconcentrated some of it. They did an excellent job of community revitalization that was for low-income people. It's a great example and a national model, really, of how you could utilize the tax credit program to improve the neighborhood without pushing people out. Now, a lot of other people have invested in that neighborhood and brought market rate homeownership, market rate rental, other things into the neighborhood, which has driven up prices, which has pushed other people out. But if it weren't for the tax credit program, investing in a high poverty, high African-American neighborhood, we could have lost a big opportunity that we now saved.
A lot of work to do. Sean Thomas, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you, though, for being here. And Sean is the chief of staff for the Ohio Housing Finance Agency. Coming up, we continue our conversation about low-income housing. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us. And in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, another hour of All Sides and getting kids out in nature. In a world filled with social media and computer games, many children now spend less than 30 minutes per week playing outside. We know getting kids contact with the outdoors can make them happier and healthier. So, coming up at 11 o'clock, exploring nature, everywhere from our backyards to national parks. That's during Hour 2 of All Sides with Ann Fisher, today from 11 till noon, on 89.7 NPR News. And the weather looks like it'll be pretty nice today. Partly sunny, a high of 85. There is a slight chance of some afternoon rain. Cloudy tonight, a low of 70 degrees. There is a chance of showers on Friday, otherwise partly sunny, and a high of 86. You're listening to 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann. Cost burdens are a long-standing condition for low-income renters. Today, the majority of poor families in the U.S. who rent housing spend more than half of their income to do so. At least one in four spends more than 70% of their income to pay their rent and utilities. Meanwhile, the stock of units affordable to very low-income households is falling far short of the growing need across the U.S. In Columbus, more than 24,000 families entered to win the lottery for housing vouchers last year. But not everyone on that 8-year waiting list received one, in part because of high demand. This hour, we're talking about affordable housing and how it can improve in Central Ohio. Still with us in the studio is Housing Administrator in the Columbus Department of Development, Rita Parise, and Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio, Bill Faith. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Gail.
Bill, housing in Columbus, in a nutshell, is a problem. It's a problem everywhere. But what are we doing to find, you know, places for these folks who maybe are on an 8-year waiting list? I mean, how many people are really struggling every day just to put a roof over their heads?
Well, it's, you know, to try to put it in terms that I think a lot more people could maybe be able to relate to, if you look at a lot of the people we're talking about are working, you know, poor. Yeah, working poor. And, you know, so if you calculate the housing wage, in other words, if you were to have an income sufficient to afford a decent place to live, the housing wage for a 2-bedroom apartment is $16 an hour. Now, our minimum wage, which is not the lowest in the country, but low, is $8 an hour, a little over $8.10 an hour. So you're needing about twice the minimum wage. And a lot of, you know, people are at that wage level. They also are not working full time. You know, their employers keep them below full time to avoid the healthcare requirements. And so, and if you're talking about families, for like a 3-bedroom apartment, you need to be making over $20 an hour. And that's just what it costs. I mean, that's here in Central Ohio. So it's no wonder that we have, you know, a big problem. It's no wonder that we have continue to have struggles with homelessness. And the Housing Authority, CMHA, operates the primary rental assistance program that's available to people. They opened up their waiting list last year for a brief, well, it's actually technically open. But in the first couple weeks, they had 25,000 applicants. They had 250 rent subsidies available.
Oh, my.
So, you know, all of those people, and unlike what some people say, housing is not an entitlement. It's not like Medicaid. If you qualify, you get it. if you qualify for rental assistance, you might have the opportunity to get on a waiting list. So the need is tremendous. And so we got to get creative with multiple different kinds of strategies to lower the cost of housing, particularly focused on you know, working poor and other people that have tremendous needs, too. Because you think about people on disability, our senior citizens, other folks that are on fixed incomes that like Social Security or disability benefits. I mean, it is a real struggle for them to be able to find and then maintain housing that they can afford.
Before we get to some solutions, let me ask you, Rita. Obviously, this is a problem the city is dealing with. What are some of the out-of-the-box solutions that maybe we're working on?
So, Gail, one of the big issues that we need to all be cognizant of is when you don't make enough money to have a suitable place to live, you are making decisions to take less. We have people who are doubling up with family or friends because they can't afford to pay rent on their own. We have folks that are living in housing that isn't decent, safe, and sanitary. And so we need to be really cognizant. I know our code enforcement office in the proactive code enforcement effort is targeting landlords that continue to have numerous code violations and surveying all of their properties, not just the ones that keep hitting the radar, but looking at all of their properties to see if it recurs. And frankly, that's one of the approaches that we're taking so that we are doing everything we can to make sure people are not living in substandard conditions. We also work very closely with the Community Shelter Board. They are the real focal point of all the homelessness efforts for both Columbus and Franklin County. And they have gone through a very comprehensive planning process over the last few years, which has resulted in the creation of a second family shelter because we have so many homeless families that we can't put them all in one shelter system. So we now have two separate shelters for families. We have put in place a system of navigators who are working with these families to take a look at what their situation is and how to transition them from shelter to housing as quickly as possible.
Emily's on the line from Dublin. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, your comment or question, please.
Well, as a real estate agent, I have people calling me weekly at a minimum, if not daily, saying that they have a Section 8 voucher. They're looking for housing, and they just can't find anyone who's willing to accept their voucher. And I have the opportunity to be in touch with people who could possibly help, but how do I get people interested in providing low-income housing, you know, and accepting a Section 8 voucher? Can you point me in the direction of some resources for information about that?
Really good question, Emily. Either of you have answers for Emily?
Well, I think it is true that there are landlords that are reluctant to accept the vouchers, particularly if you're dealing with landlords in high-cost areas like Dublin. Because they could rent it on a market rate, and they don't have to deal with the paperwork, and they don't have to have the housing inspections and the other things that go along with being a responsible acceptor of vouchers. So that I'm sure there's challenges, and if particularly people that want to move to areas like that, it's a challenge. So. I would try to work with the housing authority. They've been doing a lot of work to try to open up more landlords to accept the voucher program. They're working on other strategies that could open up more avenues to utilize vouchers, particularly in high-cost areas of the county, which they could talk about. But it's Columbus Metropolitan Housing Authority. They're the ones that administer the voucher program. And I know they're very aggressive in working on strategies to get vouchers utilized.
Rita, is there any law or legal mandate that people who own rental properties, be it houses or apartments, have to open up a portion of that to Section 8 housing? But there's no law. No, she shakes her head. No.
Sadly, there is no requirement that you provide affordable housing. Private landlords can do exactly as they please with their properties. There is a fair housing law, so you can't refuse to serve someone based on any of the fair housing criteria, including race, sex, family status, etc. But what's important to note is anything that's funded by OFA, anything that's funded by the city, we all have the requirement that you cannot refuse to serve someone because they are a voucher holder. Now, the tough part of that test is if your rent is higher than what the voucher rent is and the family can't afford to pay that, that's still going to be a barrier to them getting in. But working on trying to establish most of the stuff that the city funds is actually affordable to somebody with a voucher. Once we put the funding in, the owner, as a condition of the funding, says that they will accept people that are otherwise qualified, as long, you know, bringing the voucher with them. So, but once again, we do not have enough units. The other thing to do is, in addition to CMHA, HUD.gov has got a list of project-based Section 8 properties. And then if you look at the Ohio Housing Locator, there is actually a website, and you can find that off the OFA website, that will give you a listing in Franklin County of properties that have been funded and have made that commitment to make some of their units available to voucher holders.
Here's an email that we got. Really good question, too. Why isn't more planning done to coordinate low to moderate income housing development with public transportation? It is an important part of these folks' livelihood. And this is from Stu. He says, I see very little consideration giving to making transit a part of the development process.
Well, that's a big issue in other places. I mean, there are a lot of jurisdictions that really work at trying to make sure that those things are coordinated. We're not really there. I mean, part of it is our mass transit system is so limited. Not Dakota doesn't do a good job with what they got, but there's a lot of areas, particularly in high opportunity areas, mm-hmm. that are just not accessible to public transportation, depending on your work schedule. And frankly, a lot of the low-wage workers are not working a normal 8-to-5 kind of schedule. Or are they not working downtown? So getting to their job could be a real challenge. So it should be better coordinated. I think the person is correct. But part of it is our mass transit system lags behind as much opportunities we'd like it to provide.
And let's see. Susan, you're on the air. Susan from Columbus, welcome. What's your comment or question, please?
Hi. I'm a resident of Bollinger Tower in the Short North, and that's been in the news, not as much in the news as I think it should be, because that is the seniors are going to be back on their own, find housing, at they're giving them a housing choice voucher, and they'll have to get on waiting lists for different places. So I just wanted to get some information out there regarding that. CMHA says they have a plan in place to relocate that. But I also wanted to point out that the Italian Village Society is in favor of this Bollinger Tower in their neighborhood. They like having the diversity of people.
Susan, thank you, and good luck to you. And if folks aren't familiar, Bollinger Tower is a senior tower that is located in the Short North area that is going to be overtaken. And as Susan says, they're giving them vouchers and other things. But these seniors there, Bill, who – and you mentioned seniors who have lived there for a long time are going to need to move.
Yeah, it's a sad situation. And I wish it wasn't happening. But, a developer came in and offered to pay a big price for the property, and – I think CMHA is going to try to take that money and build other opportunities for affordable housing. But I sympathize with the caller. I think it's very distressing that we're losing that resource as a community. I think it's distressing for the residents. And I think the city has been trying to do what they can about it, but really it's a private transaction and there's not a lot you could do. I'm glad they're not going to get tax abatements to do whatever they're going to do on that site.
And how often does this happen, Rita? Do you see more and more of it then?
Not recently, thankfully. a couple things I think it's important for the caller to understand. Number one, the City of Columbus and Columbus Metropolitan Housing Authority are not the same entities. So the city does appoint people to the CMHA board, but we are not the ones that direct the activities and the business decisions that they make. Secondly, because they are protected under federal law, there is a much more comprehensive relocation package available to those residents. If you're living in private housing and your landlord decides that they're tired of you living there and they want to do something else with the property, they give you 30 days notice and send you on your way. When you have federally funded property, it's a completely different situation. And I would encourage Susan to be working with the relocation specialists that they bring to the property and make sure that they understand what her needs are, what her concerns are, where she wants to be, and certainly assist her with referrals in trying to find the right housing for her. No one, frankly, in my opinion, as an elderly person should be forced to move like this, but it is a business decision that we don't control.
We could talk about this a lot more, but I appreciate you two staying with us for the hour. We've been talking about housing problems in Columbus. I want to thank our guest, Rita Parise, the housing administrator in the Columbus Department of Development, and Bill Faith, executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio. Thank you both.
Thanks,
thank
Gail.
You.
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. And thank you for listening. All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Another hour of All Sides with Ann Fisher in just a moment. This is 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. It's 1 minute before 11 o'clock. Partly sunny and 85 today, a slight chance of afternoon rain. Cloudy and a low of 70 for tonight. Partly sunny and 86 with a slight chance of rain tomorrow.
Support for 89.7 comes from The Ohio State University College of Nursing, offering an online bachelor's degree program for registered nurses who wish to further their education. The deadline to enroll for spring semester 2017 is August 31st. More information is available at nursing.osu.edu.
This is listener-supported WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, and online at WOSU.org. A service of WOSU Public Media. 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.